The Mystery of Edwin Drood by Charles Dickens. Chapter 3. Mr. Sapsea. Accepting the jackass as the type of self-sufficient stupidity and conceit, a custom, perhaps, like some few other customs, more conventional than fair, then the purest jackass in Cloisterham is Mr. Thomas Sapsea, auctioneer. Mr. Sapsea dresses at the Dean, has been bowed down to for the Dean, in mistake, has even been spoken to in the street as my lord under the impression that he was the bishop come down unexpectedly without his chaplain. Mr. Sapsea is very proud of this and of his voice and of his style. He has even, in selling landed property, tried the experiment of slightly intoning in his pulpit to make himself more like what he takes to be the genuine ecclesiastical article. So, in ending a sale by public auction, Mr. Sapsea finishes off with an air of bestowing a benediction on the assembled brokers, which leaves the real dean, a modest and worthy gentleman, far behind. Mr. Sapsea has many admirers. Indeed, the proposition is carried by a large local majority, even including non-believers in his wisdom, that he is a credit to Cloisterham. He possesses the great qualities of being ponderous and dull, and of having a roll in his speech and another roll in his gait, not to mention a certain gravely flowing action with his hands, as if he were presently going to confirm the individual with whom he holds discourse. Much nearer 60 years of age than 50, with a flowing outline of stomach and horizontal creases in his waistcoat, reputed to be rich, voting at elections in the strictly respectable interest, morally satisfied that nothing but he himself has grown since he was a baby. How can dunder-headed Mr. Sapsea be otherwise than a credit to Cloisterham and society? Mr. Sapsea's premises are in the High Street over against the Nun's House. They are of about the period of the Nun's House, irregularly modernized here and there, as steadily deteriorating generations found more and more that they preferred air and light to fever and a plague. Over the doorway is a wooden effigy about half life-size, representing Mr. Sapsea's father, in a curly wig and toga, in the act of selling. The chastity of the idea and the natural appearance of the little finger, hammer, and pulpit have been much admired. Mr. Sapsea sits in his dull ground-floor sitting-room, giving first on his paved backyard and then on his railed-off garden. Mr. Sapsea has a bottle of port wine on a table before the fire. The fire is an early luxury, but pleasant on the cool, chilly autumn evening, and is characteristically attended by his portrait, his 8-day clock, and his weather glass. Characteristically, because he would uphold himself against mankind, his weather glass against weather, and his clock against time. By Mr. Sapsea's side on the table are a writing desk and writing materials. Glancing at a scrap of manuscript, Mr. Sapsea reads it to himself with a lofty air, and then, slowly pacing the room with his thumbs in the armholes of his waistcoat, repeats it from memory. So internally, though with much dignity, that the word Ethelinda is alone audible. There are 3 clean wine glasses in a tray on the table. His serving maid entering and announcing, "Mr. Jasper has come, sir," Mr. Sapsea waves, "admit him," and draws 2 wine glasses from the rank as being claimed. "Glad to see you, sir. I congratulate myself on having the honor of receiving you here for the first time." Mr. Sapsea does the honors of his house in this wise. "You are very good. The honor is mine, and the self-congratulation is mine." "You are pleased to say so, sir, but I do assure you that it is a satisfaction to me to receive you in my humble home, and that is what I would not say to everybody." Ineffable loftiness on Mr. Sapsea's part accompanies these words, as leaving the sentence to be understood, "You will not easily believe that your society can be a satisfaction to a man like myself. Nevertheless, it is." "I have for some time desired to know you, Mr. Sapsea."
"And I, sir, have long known you by reputation as a man of taste,
"Let me fill your glass. I will give you, sir," says Mr. Sapsea, filling his own. "When the French come over, may we meet them at Dover." This was a patriotic toast in Mr. Sapsea's infancy, and he is therefore fully convinced of its being appropriate to any subsequent era. "You can scarcely be ignorant, Mr. Sapsea," observes Jasper, watching the auctioneer with a smile as the latter stretches out his legs before the fire, "that you know the world." "Well, sir," is the chuckling reply, "I think I know something of it. Something of it." "Your reputation for that knowledge has always interested and surprised me and made me wish to know you, for Cloisterham is a little place. Cooped up in it myself, I know nothing beyond it, and feel it to be a very little place." "If I have not gone to foreign countries, young man," Mr. Sapsea begins and then stops. "You will excuse me calling you young man, Mr. Jasper. You are much my junior, by all means." "If I have not gone to foreign countries, young man, foreign countries have come to me. They have come to me in the way of business, and I have improved upon my opportunities. Put it that I take an inventory or make a catalogue. I see a French clock. I never saw him before in my life, but I instantly lay my finger on him and say, 'Paris!' I see some cups and saucers of Chinese make, equally strangers to me personally. I put my finger on them then and there, and I say, 'Peking, Nanking, and Canton.' It is the same with Japan, with Egypt, and with bamboo and sandalwood from the East Indies. I put my finger on them all. I have put my finger on the North Pole before now and said, 'Spear of Esquimo, make for a half pint of pale sherry.'"
"Really? A very remarkable way, Mr. Sapsea, of acquiring a knowledge of men and things."
"I mention it, sir," Mr. Sapsea rejoins with unspeakable complacency, "because, as I say, it don't do to boast of what you are, but show how you came to be it, and then you prove it."
Most interesting we were to speak of the late Mrs. Sapsea.
"We were, sir," Mr. Sapsea fills both glasses and takes the decanter into safekeeping again. "Before I consult your opinion as a man of taste on this little trifle," holding it up, "which is but a trifle and still has required some thought, sir, some little fever of the brow, I ought perhaps to describe the character of the late Mrs. Sapsea, now dead 3/4 of a year." Mr. Jasper, in the act of yawning behind his wine glass, puts down that screen and calls up a look of interest. It is a little impaired in its expressiveness by his having a shut-up gape still to dispose of, with watering eyes.
"Half a dozen years ago or so," Mr. Sapsea proceeds, "when I had enlarged my mind up to, I will not say to what it now is, for that might seem to aim at too much, but up to the pitch of wanting another mind to be absorbed in it, I cast my eye about me for a nuptial partner, because, as I say, it is not good for man to be alone."
Mr. Jasper appears to commit this original idea to memory.
"Miss Bravity, at that time kept, I will not call it the rival establishment, to the establishment at the Nun's House opposite, but I will call it the other parallel establishment downtown. The world did have it that she showed a passion for attending my sales, and when they took place on half-holidays, or in vacation time. The world did put it about that she admired my style. The world did notice that, as time flowed by, my style became traceable in the dictation exercises of Miss Bravity's pupils. Young man, a whisper even sprang up in obscure malignity that one ignorant and besotted churl, a parent, so committed himself as to object to it by name. But I do not believe this, for it is likely that any human creature in his right senses would so lay himself open to be pointed at by what I call the finger of scorn."
Mr. Jasper shakes his head. "Not in the least likely." Mr. Sapsea, in a grandiloquent state of absence of mind, seems to refill his visitor's glass, which is full already, and does really refill his own, which is empty. "Miss Bravity's being, young man, was deeply imbued with homage to mind. She revered mind when launched, or, as I say, precipitated to an extensive knowledge of the world.
When I made my proposal, she did me the honor to be so overshadowed with a species of awe as to be able to articulate only the two words, "Oh, thou," meaning myself. Her limpid blue eyes were fixed upon me. Her semi-transparent hands were clasped together. Pallor overspread her aquiline features, and though encouraged to proceed, she never did proceed a word further. I disposed of the parallel establishment by private contract, and we became as nearly one as could be expected under the circumstances. But she never could, and she never did, find a phrase satisfactory to put her perhaps too favorable estimate of my intellect. To the very last feeble action of liver, she addressed me in the same unfinished terms. Mr. Jasper has closed his eyes as the auctioneer has deepened his voice. He now abruptly opens them and says, in unison with the deepened voice, "Ah!" Rather, as if stopping himself on the extreme verge of adding, "Men." "I have been since," says Mr. Sapsey, with his legs stretched out and solemnly enjoying himself with the wine and the fire, "what you behold me. I have been since a solitary mourner. I have been since, as I say, wasting my evening conversation on the desert air. I will not say that I have reproached myself, but there have been times when I have asked myself the question, what if her husband had been nearer on a level with her? If she had not had to look up quite so high, what might the stimulating action have been upon the liver?" Mr. Jasper says, with an appearance of having fallen into dreadfully low spirits, that he supposes it was to be. "We can only suppose so, sir," Mr. Sapsey coincides. "As I say, man proposes, heaven disposes. It may or may not be putting the same thought in another form, but that is the way I put it." Mr. Jasper murmurs assent. "And now, Mr. Jasper," resumes the auctioneer, producing his scrap of manuscript, "Mrs. Sapsey's monument, having had full time to settle and dry, let me take your opinion as a man of taste on the inscription I have, as I before remarked, not without some little fever of the brow, drawn out for it. Take it in your own hand. The setting out of the line requires to be followed with the eye as well as the contents with the mind." Mr. Jasper, complying, sees and reads as follows: "Ethelinda, reverential wife of Mr. Thomas Sapsey, auctioneer, valuer, estate agent, and etc. of this city, whose knowledge of the world, though somewhat extensive, never brought him acquainted with a spirit more capable of looking up to him, stranger, pause and ask thyself the question, canst thou do likewise? If not, with a brush, retire." Mr. Sapsey, having risen and stationed himself with his back to the fire, for the purpose of observing the effect of these lines on the countenance of a man of taste, consequently has his face toward the door, when his serving-maid, again appearing, announces, "Duttles is come, sir." He promptly draws forth and fills the third wine glass, as being now claimed, and replies, "Show Duttles in." "Admirable," quoth Mr. Jasper, handing back the paper.
"You approve, sir?"
"Impossible not to approve. Striking, characteristic, and complete." The auctioneer inclines his head as one accepting his due and giving a receipt, and invites the entering Duttles to take off that glass of wine, handing the same, "for it will warm him." Duddles is a stonemason, chiefly in the gravestone, tomb, and monument way, and wholly of their color from head to foot. No man is better known in Cleisterham. He is the chartered libertine of the place. Fame trumpets him a wonderful workman, which for aught that anybody knows he may be, as he never works, and a wonderful sot, which everybody knows he is. With the cathedral crypt he is better acquainted than any living authority. It may even be than any dead one. It is said that the intimacy of this acquaintance began in his habitually resorting to that secret place to lock out the cloisterham boy populace and sleep off fumes of liquor, he having ready access to the cathedral as contractor for rough repairs. Be this as it may, he does know much about it, and in the demolition of impedimental fragments of wall, buttress, and pavement, has seen strange sights. He often speaks of himself in the third person, perhaps being a little misty as to his own identity, when he narrates, perhaps impartially adopting the cloisterham nomenclature in reference to a character of acknowledged distinction. Thus, he will say, touching his strange sights, Duddles come upon the old chap, in reference to a buried magnate of ancient time and high degree, by striking right into the coffin with his pick. The old chap gave Duddles a look with his open eyes, as much as to say, Is your name Duddles? Why, my man, I've been waiting for you a devil of a time. And then he turned to powder. With a 2-foot rule always in his pocket, and a mason's hammer all but always in his hand, Duddles goes continually sounding and tapping all about and about the cathedral, and whenever he says to Topi, Topi, he is another old one in here, Topi announces it to the dean as an established discovery. In a suit of coarse flannel with horn buttons, a yellow neckerchief with daggled ends, an old hat, more russet-colored than black, and laced boots of the hue of his stony calling, Duddles leads a hazy gypsy sort of life, carrying his dinner about with him in a small bundle, and sitting on all manner of tombstones to dine. This dinner of Duddles has become quite a cloisterham institution, not only because of his never appearing in public without it, but because of its having been, on certain renowned occasions, taken into custody, along with Duddles, as drunk and incapable, and exhibited before the bench of justices at the town hall. These occasions, however, have been few and far apart, Duddles being as seldom drunk as sober. For the rest, he is an old bachelor, and he lives in a little antiquated hole of a house that was never finished, supposed to be built so far of stones stolen from the city wall. To this abode there is an approach, ankle-deep in stone chips, resembling a petrified grove of tombstones, urns, draperies, and broken columns in all stages of sculpture. Herein two journeymen incessantly chip, while other two journeymen, who face each other, incessantly saw stone, dipping as regularly in and out of their sheltering sentry boxes as if they were mechanical figures emblematical of time and death. To Duddles, when he had consumed his glass of port, Mr. Sapsey entrusts that precious effort of his muse. Duddles unfeelingly takes out his 2-foot rule and measures the lines calmly, alloying them with stone grit.
This is for the monument, is it, Mr. Sapsey?
The inscription, yes,
Mr. Sapsey waits for its effect on a common mind.
It'll come in to an 1/8 inch, says Duddles.
Your servant, Mr. Jasper. Hope I see you well. How are you, Duddles?
I've got a touch of tumbleism on me, Mr. Jasper, but that I must expect.
You mean the rheumatism,
said Sapsey in a sharp tone. He is nettled by having his composition so mechanically received.
No, I don't mean, Mr. Sapsey, the tumbleism. It's another sort of rheumatism. Mr. Jasper knows what Duddles means. You get among them tombs, the fours will light on a winter morning, and keep on, as the catechism says, a-walkin' in the same other days of your life, and you'll know what Duddles means.
It is a bitter cold place, Mr. Jasper assents, with an antipathetic shiver.
And if it's bitter cold for you up in the chancel, with a lot of live breath smoking out about you, what the bitterness is to Duddles down in the crypt among the earthy damps there, and the dead breath of the old ones returns that individual, Duddles leaves you to judge. Is this to be put in hand at once, Mr. Sapsey?
Mr. Sapsey, with an author's anxiety to rush into publication, replies that it cannot be out of hand too soon.
"You had better let me have the key, then," says Duttles.
"Why, man, it is not to be put inside the monument."
"Duttles knows where it's to be put, Mr. Sapsey, no man better. Ask your men in Cloisterham whether Duttles knows his work."
Mr. Sapsey rises, takes a key from a drawer, unlocks an iron safe, and let into the wall, and takes from it another key.
When Duddles puts a torch or a finish upon this work, no matter where, inside or outside, Duddles likes to look at his work all around and see that his work is doing him credit, Duddles explains doggedly.
The key proffered him by the bereaved widower being a large one, he slips his 2-foot rule into a side pocket of his flannel trousers made for it, and deliberately opens his flannel coat and opens the mouth of a large breast pocket within it before taking the key to place it in that repository.
"Why, Duddles," exclaims Jasper, looking on amused, "you are undermined with pockets." "And I carries weight in 'em too, Mr. Jasper. Feel those!"
producing 2 other large keys.
"Hand me, Mr. Sapsey's likewise. Surely this is the heaviest of the 3. "You'll find them much of a muchness, I expect," says Duddles. "They all belong to monuments. They all open Duddles' work. Duddles keeps the keys of his work mostly. Not that they're much used."
"By the by," it comes into Jasper's mind to say, as he idly examines the keys, "I have been going to ask you many a day and have always forgotten. You know they sometimes call you Stony Duddles, don't you?"
"Cloisterham knows me as Duddles, Mr. Jasper."
"I am aware of that, of course, but the boys sometimes..."
"Oh, if you don't mind them young imps of boys," Duddles gruffly interrupts.
"I don't mind them any more than you do, but there was a discussion the other day among the choir whether Stony stood for Tony, clinking one key against another."
"Take care of the wards, Mr. Jasper."
"Or whether Stony stood for Stephen, clinking with a change of keys."
"You can't make a pitch pipe of him, Mr. Jasper."
"Or whether the name comes from your trade. How stands the fact?" Mr. Jasper weighs the 3 keys in hand, lifts his head from his oddly stooping attitude over the fire, and delivers the keys to Duddles with an ingenuous and friendly face. But the Stony one is a gruff one likewise, and that hazy state of his is always an uncertain state, highly conscious of its dignity and prone to take offense. He drops his 2 keys back into his pocket one by one and buttons them up. He takes his dinner bundle from the chair back on which he hung it when he came in. He distributes the weight he carries by tying the 3rd key up in it as though he were an ostrich and liked to dine off the cold iron. And he gets out of the room, deigning no word of answer. Mr. Sapsey then proposes a hit at backgammon, which, seasoned with his own improving conversation and terminating in a supper of cold roast beef and salad, beguiles the golden evening until pretty late. Mr. Sapsey's wisdom being, in its delivery to mortals, rather of the diffuse than the epigrammatic order, is by no means extended even then. But his visitor intimates that he will come back for more of the precious commodity on future occasions, and Mr. Sapsey lets him off for the present to ponder on the installment he carries away. End of chapter. Read by Leonidas for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.